BUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In 1993, a quirky ideologue who believed that technology would turn the world order upside down launched a magazine that came to define the ethos of the internet boom. Wired magazine was a nonstop manifesto machine, the day-glow herald of a new age. But the roots of its ideology may surprise you. Tonight on Point, the story of Louis Rossetto and his Wired revolution. We begin with the latest from Iraq. Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz is still touring the country, assessing a troubled occupation. There was another U.S. soldier killed today, and word that Washington is scrambling to keep U.S. troops supplied with sufficient food and body armor. John Hendren is Pentagon correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, reporting from Baghdad. I asked him about the Pentagon's strategy for sustaining the occupation of Iraq.
The first thing they're going to try to do is to get Iraqis more involved with the civil defense force. Part of the idea behind having an Iraqi civil defense force is to have a sort of non-police unit, sort of paramilitaries, who, in addition to working with the U.S. military, would also be able to work among Iraqis and be able to get the kind of intelligence that Americans just are not able to get. The Pentagon is also planning on using more light infantry troops as opposed to the heavily armored divisions that you see throughout Iraq now, with the idea being that they could more quickly sweep in and strike these groups of guerrillas that they're finding through some of the intelligence that they have.
Does that mean bringing in different American troops or just using the troops there in a different manner?
My impression was that it did mean bringing in different troops. In particular, the 3rd Infantry Division, which is a mechanized division with tanks and Bradley fighting vehicles. They have been here for 10 months. They will have been here nearly a year before they can go home, earliest probably in September. My guess is that they will be replaced by a lighter unit, perhaps even an international unit, and one that would be designed to more quickly go after some of these intelligence targets that the U.S. Central Command is targeting.
And you mentioned the obvious desire to get Iraqis more involved in Iraqi security, but how long will it take before there's a sufficient number to make a real difference in what's required of American troops there?
That's a good question. It looks like it's going to take about a couple of months to get anything like a significant number of Iraqis involved in this force, a few thousand. And it's going to take that amount of time to change over the U.S. force. We've got some foreign troops, I believe something like 30,000 expected to come in by September. But that's 2 critical months in which U.S. soldiers and British troops as well are facing attacks on a daily basis.
John, how are U.S. troops handling this awful drip torture of almost daily killings of American troopers there?
With gallows humor and eagerness to go home for many of them. If you talk to units that have been here a very long time, they're all anxious to go home. The 3rd Infantry Division has been told more than once that it's likely to go home. Recently, it was told so by both the Secretary of Defense and by their own commanding general. And then we're told that, in fact, they're going to have to stay. But the morale is not always good. On the other hand, it's not as if you see people going AWOL. They're sticking it out. They just would like to get home soon.
You've been in Fallujah recently. How keen is the concern about personal safety of soldiers there and elsewhere?
They're definitely aware of that. I was with a reserve unit the other night, and these are MPs from Rhode Island, and they said they've faced gunfire nearly every night on their patrols. They're clearly on edge. I went on a patrol with them where there was some AK-47 fire and tracers fired near them, and members of them have been hit with RPGs, with gunfire, and they're definitely anxious about it.
Paul Bremer, of course, has been in Washington this weekend and painting a fairly positive picture of what's going on there. Have you heard American military personnel in Iraq responding to that picture? Would they confirm it if asked?
I think you will get people, particularly officers, who will say that there are signs of progress. And indeed, there do seem to be some. There are areas like Fallujah where there have been fewer incidents than there had been in the past. On the other hand, they haven't crushed this resistance movement, and there are some signs that the movement itself is getting more organized, that it is getting more sophisticated. That's something that General John Abizaid, the new head of the Central Command, told reporters here in Baghdad just yesterday.
And John, can you feel the search for Saddam Hussein as you move around Iraq there? Are people talking about it? Are there jeeps screaming off in the night after reports coming in that he might be here or there? Or is it a kind of underground subterranean effort?
It seems to be more of the latter. I think often what is happening is that there is intelligence that there is some regime official in one particular location. You end up having troops storm that building, and they don't know if Saddam Hussein himself was there or not. And I think that was illustrated in this Syrian border incident in which the U.S. Air Force had bombed a convoy. I talked to people in the Pentagon afterward, and it was clearly not clear to them whether Saddam Hussein or his sons were in that convoy at the time of the bombing. It was something they hoped but did not know.
What about the relationship between the U.S. military and Iraqis in the streets, in their interactions, in office buildings? Can you see this going in a positive direction?
Well, they are often welcomed in the streets outside of central Iraq, in Najaf, Karbala, and in Basra to the south, and in cities like Mosul to the north. You often do see these streets lined with people just waving to the American convoys. Then again, in central Iraq is where they're doing a lot of the raids, where they're doing a lot of activities that are angering people, and you've got innocent people being detained inevitably because they're in the wrong place at the wrong time. You have right now today in Baghdad Shiite protesters who are upset about a number of people who have been detained who are among the Shiite leadership in the area. And that is what threatens to turn the tide into a larger movement. So far, you've got small groups in this so-called Sunni triangle of central Iraq that are clearly opposed to the occupation. But what you haven't seen is the majority Shiite population join in that kind of opposition. That would be a potential critical problem to the coalition.
So as you see it tonight, John, is this situation deteriorating? Is it moving in a positive direction? Is it still balancing on a knife edge between the two?
It seems to be balancing on a knife edge. It could go really either way. There does seem to be some progress in terms of at least minimizing the attacks. You're still getting daily attacks in which one, even two soldiers are killed. Today you had a soldier and a translator killed in an incident. But at the same time, the rebels have not been able to expand these attacks to strike large numbers of troops, and the military sees that as a positive sign, and they have a plan to try to crush the rebellion. And part of it is that the economy turns around and some of these services like electricity and water come back. They're hoping that people will settle down and stop supporting some of these rebels.
John Hendren, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
John Hendren is Pentagon correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. He spoke with us from Baghdad. In many ways, the fundamental ideas that wrapped the internet boom of the 90s in a cloak of revolution were shaped by the politics and iconoclastic philosophy of one man who believed that technology and those who developed and used it would render the old world order obsolete. Social fabric, politics, business models would all make way for a new free interchange that would not be confined by national borders. A tech-driven market meritocracy would smash old media and corporate dinosaurs and reshape the world in its new image. Louis Rossetto was a connoisseur of chaos and a radical 60s libertarian. When it was more hip to be a hippie, after decades of wandering the globe, he helped galvanize the internet decade with his fiery personal ideology. With a layout and palette as provocative as his ideas, Wired magazine was a physical manifestation of the radical changes that were forecast in its pages. It is remarkable now to consider how much of the 90s zeitgeist came from the day globe bullhorn of one iconoclastic man. Did you read Wired magazine? Did the digital revolution get its teeth into you? Are they still there? And where is that revolution now? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York City is Gary Wolf, former executive editor of Hotwired, Wired magazine's online initiative, and author of the new book, Wired, A Romance. Good evening and welcome, Gary Wolf.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for being with us. Wow. Gary Wolf, you've told a remarkable story here, and I thought I knew it all, and I guess I didn't really know the half of it. You were up close and personal for a long time with Wired magazine, with Wired's online efforts, with the founder and driving force behind Wired.
Louis Rossetto, what a background this guy had. And I ended up reading your book, and it's a terrific story. It is, of course, in part about the magazine itself, and its interaction with the IPO market and its origins and all the craziness we associate with that time. But I found myself really struck, most of all, by the man behind it. Before we go back and look at his personal history, and it's quite a history, excuse me, give us a sense, Gary Wolfe, of how you assess Wired's impact in shaping the big kind of uber messages of the 1990s. There were a lot of bullhorns out there, but this was perhaps a unique bullhorn.
Yes, I think it was. And before I answer that, I just want to say I thought your introduction was really interesting, and I appreciated it because I think when I sat down to address this story, I thought, you know, the world doesn't really need another dot-com rise and fall book. There have been many of them. People know that story. But that's not the whole story of what happened in the 90s and what happened, not only in San Francisco and in New York, the centers of tech and finance, but what happened all over the world. And I thought maybe I could take this story and touch on some of those broader themes that you brought up in your intro. I think they're much more interesting really now. And I think as more time goes by and people lose the sting in their pocketbook, they'll recognize that our social life has been touched in a lot more ways than are expressed in the rise and fall of the stock market charts.
So, absolutely. And I want to get to that tonight. But I found this kind of what was for me and a previously untold story of Louis Rossetto.
Yes.
Really remarkable.
Yes.
Before we go back and get the origins of his worldview, how would you put it in a sentence or two, the kind of Wired manifesto, the Wired worldview that drove the 90s?
Yes, and I think the question that you started out with, which I did mean to get around to, is really a great one. What was the impact? What was the message and what was the impact of that message? And I think one of the most difficult things about telling the story and also about consuming the story is getting rid of the foreshortening, the historical foreshortening that we have, where we tend to see the things that happened between 1997 and 2000 as being the whole story, and we lose what happened in the 90s from, say, 1992 to 1997.
Not to mention the 80s and the 70s and the 60s, where you also see origins.
Exactly. Here. And so the message of Wired was that technology would make every existing authority obsolete. And this message, which he put out in January of 1993, came out before, for instance, the graphical web browser was even invented. So nobody was browsing the web at that point. People who are internet connoisseurs and historians will remember some of the obscure protocols we used to use.
But that speaks to how bold a claim this was, because Mosaic wasn't there. The interface wasn't even there.
Exactly. People just didn't use their computers to engage the world culturally. It just didn't happen at that time. So to say that computers will make every existing authority obsolete, to say that it will destroy the masters of media as we know them today, to say that it will remake politics, to say that it will remake social life in terms of how people meet each other, in terms of what kinds of social groups can form, in terms of how people consume music and movies. These were claims that were almost on the verge of insane. They weren't unprecedented. There were certainly people associated, say, with the invention of the Macintosh in 1993, Steve Wozniak, Steve Jobs. You know, you may remember those famous 1984 commercial where they showed somebody, you know,
destroying a sledgehammer through the big screen, Big Brother.
Yes, destroying Big Brother with the power of computing. So those messages were out there. But Wired really packaged it and made it a popular phenomenon. And I think it's not an exaggeration to say that Wired is the most significant new magazine since perhaps Rolling Stone, which coincidentally was also started in San Francisco.
And started in the teeth of, or maybe provoked, another revolution. I was so struck at the power that these messages had in seeming to just blow up full-blown at the very start. If you hadn't been listening, if you hadn't been reading, if you hadn't been following Louis Rossetto, it looked as though somehow this whole philosophy and worldview just one day woke up in San Francisco, and that itself gave it a tremendous power. But you tell us an awful lot about where it came from, and we're going to turn to that. Gary Wolfe, stand by. We're looking tonight at the untold story of the ultimate internet revolutionary, how one man's politics shaped the ideology of the internet boom. You can join the conversation. Did the idea of the digital revolution get its teeth into you? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking tonight about the story of perhaps the ultimate Internet revolutionary, how one man's politics shaped the ideology of the Internet boom. That man, Louis Rossetto, the founder of Wired Magazine. Our guest tonight, Gary Wolf, was intimately involved in Wired Magazine, and he's out with a new book now called Wired, A Romance. We'll talk about why it's a romance. But Gary Wolf, I was so taken with the story of where this all came from. Of course, we know Wired was right in the middle of everything and had these wild graphics and having to read it upside down and backwards and inside out and challenging everybody to wonder if they knew anything about what was going on in the world at all. You write about how at a certain point in the 90s, very staid businessmen would subscribe just to have it around the office to give themselves a sheen of tech chic.
It was a badge of honor.
A badge of honor. But the philosophy, the political view, had such a long history behind it and such a, in a way, peculiar and singular history. I wish you'd take us back and introduce us really all the way back through even the father of Louis Rossetto. Give us a sense of who this guy was, where he came from, and the very long and winding trail that left him standing there suddenly with the bullhorn of the digital revolution.
Well, that, I think, was the most exciting thing about the story to me. These threads of history, obscure threads, which suddenly tie up and become something really popular and really visible. You know, he has told the story himself many times, and it's been told in many magazine profiles about coming to America with no job and no home and no money and starting this magazine.
Though he was American and he was coming from Europe.
Yes.
But you really take it back beyond that.
Yes. Well, he didn't have he had no money, not because he couldn't have made any, but because money wasn't of primary importance to him then. He was a political radical. He was one of the early, really important members of the libertarian movement in New York in 1972. He had moved from a sort of Rockefeller republicanism, where he was really a misfit,
He came to Columbia in 1967 and declared himself for Nixon.
Yes, exactly. He was a Nixon supporter, but only briefly, because he was sort of a long-haired intellectual who thought, you know, that human freedom was being suppressed by the forces of authority.
And briefly, president of the Columbia Young Republicans.
Yes, yes, exactly. And, you know, he has an MBA from Columbia, but at that time, you know, the boring American corporation was not going to produce the kind of social effects that he was interested in. And so he lit out for Europe, and he had an uncanny sense of incipient revolution. He was in Sri Lanka when the Tamil Rebellion broke out. He was in Rome when the violence by the Red Brigades hit its peak. He was in Afghanistan when the CIA first started shipping in those Stinger missiles that the Muslim rebels used to attack the Soviets.
In fact, he was one of the first to write about that.
That's right.
And you point
that's
out that Louis Rossetto became a kind of connoisseur of chaos. He saw all the potential for chaos and upheaval to create windows of opportunity, one of those
Exactly. And when you combine that with, as you mentioned before, his peculiar background, because his father had worked as an engineer and executive at the Mergenthaler Linotype Company in Brooklyn. And the Mergenthaler Linotype Company, a company very few people have heard of, was a company founded by the guy who invented automatic typesetting, which really created a revolution in media that is perhaps comparable to what we were seeing in the 90s. The modern mass print media is completely derived from the invention of automatic typesetting.
So he had watched his father be involved with the technology that in an earlier generation made a kind of revolution of its own.
That's right. And so when he first got a glimpse of what computers were able to do, and we're talking about desktop publishing now, not the Internet, in the 80s, he looked on it not necessarily as a business opportunity, although he had a business degree and was business oriented. He looked on it as an opportunity to foment revolution. And because he was had been a libertarian, and eventually he discards the label libertarian, finding it too political. He doesn't believe really in politics at all.
Yeah, but because briefly an anarchist, he was a volunteer at the abolitionist.
Exactly. Just a radical guy, but not a radical in the sense of a leftist radical, a market-oriented radical, a guy who believes that the market can never be wrong, and if there are distortions or mistakes that are made in the commercial world, it's because somebody is getting in the way. often the government.
You have him on the cover of the New York Times Magazine, and I guess this must have been the early 70s.
73, I think, or
73,
two, yeah.
As a representative of this new type of radical, with the libertarian slogan that Louis Rossetto is quoted with inside, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what your country is doing to you.
Yes.
That's a little bit, yes, not only of later of a digital revolutionary, but a little bit of a Gingrich revolutionary.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, this thread kind of comes around and is woven into the narrative later because, of course, once Wired starts, you have a battle over who speaks for the digital revolution. You have Al Gore on the one hand kind of talking about safe change and bringing, you know, leaving nobody behind as the world completely turns inside out. And then you have Newt Gingrich, who is talking about ripping everything down to the foundation and starting all over again. And both of them claim that the internet is a tool for their version of governance. And, you know, Lewis is positioned to kind of shine a bright light on both of those claims.
You write about Louis Rossetto, this effect he had on people. You say he was like a magnet whose grip increased dramatically at close range, and you recount many instances where that happened. But he also had this idea from many experiences, from his own political leanings, that great change could come from the right leverage point, even if it looked small. I mean, you recount this incredible story of him ghostwriting a book called Ultimate Porno by the,
yes,
was the co-director of Caligula, the Gorbidal so-called sex colossal.
Yes, exactly.
And,
you know,
and the theme there being that established hierarchies are easily hijacked by individuals of conviction and stamina. Where did that lesson last?
Yes. I mean, you know, that was that's just one of the many, many, many strange situations that gave him a particular perspective, especially a distrust of conventional wisdom, because he was sitting in his apartment in Rome and listening to the stories being told by the guy whose book he ghost wrote about what was going on the set of that movie. And that was just a case where, you know, between the mafia and the strange financiers and the sexual revolution in Rome in 1972, where it seemed like nobody was in charge. And when there's a situation where nobody's in charge, really it's the person with the most conviction and the most stamina that ends up being the leader.
And Louis Rossetto had that in spades long before he hit Wired magazine. The internet was not the first technology that he fiercely got his teeth into.
Well, he was interested first in desktop publishing. And he had a magazine in Amsterdam. It really was an incredible cult magazine called Electric Word, which made the same claims that Wired made. But it was had a much smaller and more narrow audience. It was aimed at people who were already involved professionally in using these technologies.
But it's a fascinating thing you just said there. It made the same claims that Wired made long before the internet existed at all, as though Louis Rossetto was waiting for this technology or jumping on anyone that might promise the political liberation he had in mind.
That's absolutely true. You know, I think that's often the case with new technologies. They fill a role in a worldview that has already been prepared for them in advance. Mm-hmm. We think that the technologies create the worldview. But in fact, I think as this book shows and others have shown, what happens is people's understanding and their fantasies and their beliefs get ahead of the technology. And then the technology fills in.
But one thing he didn't really have was money, though he found ways to get it here and there, to get magazines up and going. But when he and his wife, Jane, made,
yes,
their way to
they're
the,
not married,
okay,
but they're not, partners
all right,
and have
partners,
kids together.
Right. Made their way to the United States. The idea of starting a magazine that would once again look to push the United States, the world, the planet, up onto,
yes,
a new kind of trajectory was completely, yeah, on his mind, even though he had almost nothing when he came back home.
Well, you know, I think that they were so desperate at that point. I mean, I tell this story and it has many twists and turns, but they just reached a point where they'd mortgaged everything in their lives to create this revolution. It's like Lenin being put on the sealed train, you know, and sent across into Russia. Really, it was revolution or death for them, and metaphorically speaking. And I think they managed to get one issue of this magazine out. That's really what they were aiming for. They thought, let's try to do it once. And they expected that having done it once, they would get at least some support. What they didn't expect was to do one issue and have the thing explode phenomenally. And from then on, it was all they could do to stay in control, because they put out that one issue and it was devoured. People couldn't get enough of it. They were planning on fulfilling subscriptions from their office, just taking the envelopes and opening them and sending out a magazine to somebody who wrote in.
And then came the bag after bag after bag of cards.
Now, just cards everywhere.
Now, the Wired philosophy came partly right out of Louis Rossetto's head, but you also looked at a lineage of thinkers about technology, deeply read within certain tech communities, but not widely read in the United States. I wonder if you could cite a couple of those other key books or writers who had, over the preceding decades, begun to kind of lay the framework for this view of the world.
Well, the one I think people would really enjoy looking at, if they can find a copy in a used bookstore or on the web somewhere, is a book called Computer Lib by Ted Nelson. This is a book that was published actually right around the same time Lewis was active in the Libertarian Party in the early 70s. And it was the seminal work. It was published by a small press. It was never really reviewed. And yet it was known and widely loved by real computer people,
and
by programmers. Its thesis was that computers had to be in the hands of the people now. That was a kind of, it was a 60s style thesis. It wasn't quite Lewis's thesis that computers were going to make every existing authority obsolete, but it was close. It was saying that if we leave computers in the hands of professionals and experts, they will be tools used to dominate us. But if ordinary people learn how to use computers, they can be tools of liberation. Now, keep in mind, when Ted Nelson was writing, when Lewis was writing, there was at least a personal computer.
Right.
When Ted Nelson was writing, there were mainframe computers.
Room size.
So he was really, this is why it was only embraced by computer people. Most ordinary people were not going to go and take a computer class and learn how to do computer programming and, you know, this sort of thing and get access to a computer at their local university. It was very far out.
But all this was packed kind of in the back of the mind of Louis Rossetto as he backpacked around the world and eventually made his way back to the United States. We're going to look at how Wired took off with all of this background behind it, but we have callers who want to join this, and I want to invite them in. Jay is calling from North Andover, Massachusetts. Hi, Jay. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks. Boy, what a setup. All the things you've just been saying are so perfect. You talked about the foundation of ideas being fulfilled later by technology and then by authors who set up this possible thing.
The idea is preceding the technology. It sort of reverses our natural presumption, but there it is.
I can't then let this go by without bringing up William Gibson's Neuromancer, because it's a staggeringly perfect book, because everybody who'd read the book saw this amazing vision of a very anarchistic future with very interconnected technology, people plugging directly into this network, and it was a little fanciful by plugging your brain into the wire, but nonetheless it was a massive ability to gather stuff and be in places, and Wired represented, I think, the present day expression of what was possible in the Neuromancer fantasy world, but happening now in the real world. And Wired was just stepped into a perfect place in my little brain as a technologist.
Stepped right into the place that William Gibson, the novelist, had made there. Jay, thanks for that observation. Gary Wolf, you're very clear that Louis Rossetto was not the only person thinking along these lines. William Gibson out there. You cite George Gilder, Stuart Brand, each of them, and others, helping set the table.
Yes, and I think Stuart Brand is another. Well, first of all, William Gibson was a huge influence on the people at Wired, and he was also somebody who wrote for the magazine, and he really did prepare the way. In fact, I believe it was Time magazine who either that year or maybe even the year before had done some kind of cover story on cyberpunks. So the world, not only was the world prepared for the place that technology came to fill, but the world was prepared for the place that Wired came to fill. That's how something takes off so successfully. Nobody really knew where it was going to be. Was it going to be cyberpunk? Was it going to be science fiction? Mm-hmm. And Wired was perfectly constructed to bring all of those threads together. Now, as to Stuart Brand is also a great person to mention in here, because people know him probably through his work on the Whole Earth Catalog.
Sure.
That was his great bestseller from 1968. Fewer people probably know that with the profits from the Whole Earth Catalog, Stuart Brand and some of his cohorts, including the guy who became executive editor of Wired, Kevin Kelly, started a small online service in San Francisco called The Well. And The Well was really the birthing ground of Wired. It was a place where journalists and designers and writers and programmers all spoke to each other. And at that time, that mix was very rare. Wired helped make that seem sort of normal. Of course, designers are interested in computers and computer people are interested in design. Mm. But Wired was the place where that entered the popular culture. The Well was the place where it really started to happen.
And out of that whole conversation and this remarkable personal story of Rosetto, you describe him as seeing Wired as an advocate for what he liked to call spontaneous order. Now, fill out the picture here for us. He really did want a new world. He hated the old media. He thought that they were suffocating change, suffocating humanity. He wanted a dispersal of power and freedom and interconnectedness. But spontaneous order, what does that mean?
Well, spontaneous order is a term that I believe has its roots in the very libertarian milieu out of which he came. I did look it up at one point and tracked it down to, and I can't remember off the top of my head who first uttered those words. But it means that left to themselves, people will optimize over the entire group. They won't just optimize their personal situation, but they'll create an optimal situation for the whole group. And of course, the idea clearly goes back to Adam Smith and, you know, basic theories of capitalism. But Lewis took it completely seriously at the micro level as well as the macro level. And he wanted his company to be spontaneously ordered, as well as the world that his company was trying to make.
And so it became kind of the harbinger of the pizza-strewn chaos.
Yes, exactly. It was spontaneous. Cliche. The question is whether it was orderly. But he saw that as an incredibly fertile and creative environment in which to put out a magazine. And I have to say, the magazine was incredible. It exacted a huge toll, not only on his employees, on his partners and suppliers, but on himself. And I think later in the story, as things turn a little dark, you find him being battled by people who don't believe in spontaneous order. They believe in rigorous order. And, you know, he puts himself a little bit at a disadvantage in relation to those really hardcore end games that are being played with him by the bankers.
Well, I want to come back and get your assessment of who had the last laugh here, spontaneous order or rigorous order, and also of how, given your intimate working life and now having written about Lewis Rosetto, you know, how you divide the proportions here of visionary, of charlatan. Maybe it's not a word you use at all, but I have to ask and wonder, given how it all turned out. You know how Stephen Jobs was often said by his employees to possess a reality distortion field.
That's right.
Around him, that Lewis Rosetto had something of the same thing.
Sure.
We're talking tonight with Gary Wolfe. He's author of the new book, Wired, A Romance. And it's a remarkable story of where that whole darn decade came from. Anyway, you can join our conversation tonight. Was the web a natural ally of libertarians, a natural enemy of the status quo? Did the status quo win? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Support for this program comes. We're talking tonight about the untold story of perhaps the ultimate internet revolutionary, how one man's politics shaped the ideology of the internet boom. That man, Lewis Rosetto, founder of Wired magazine, as told through the terrific new book, Wired, A Romance, by Gary Wolfe, who was also part of the Wired years out in San Francisco. You can join the conversation. Did Lewis Rosetto's Wired mess with your mind? And was the Wired manifesto naive or right on or ahead of its time? How does it look? How does it sound? How do you remember it now? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Mike is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I was a subscriber or whatever. I've read it pretty irregularly, but faithfully since about 96. And it was just an amazing magazine. I mean, it was like incredibly visionary in almost every respect, whether it was they're talking about technology, about things that were going to happen, about how it was going to affect society. But one of the things that nobody's talked about, it had the most incredible photographs I've really ever seen. I mean, it had the candy-colored layout, you know, just amazing, stunning things. The one I really remember was a picture of a couple in a wedding dress, this wide shot of them walking through these ruins of Beirut that was just absolutely breathtaking. I mean, I blew it up into a poster. It was so amazing. But other things they had was every issue had about one or two companies that in a year or so was going to explode, you know, fivefold or tenfold in the stock market. And you could make some real money by reading Wired magazine and you know, playing them at the right times.
Yeah, or you could believe it anyway. Yeah. Mike, thanks so much for your call. It is so true. The graphics were incredible. The stories had amazing bite. They came to be Wired, came to be, though, Gary Wolf, described by some people as intimidating propaganda that actually drove, maybe even helped create, the bubble.
Well, you know, my favorite story about intimidation was told to me by Nathan Myhrvold, who was a top executive at Microsoft, a brilliant guy, technologist, PhD, and he describes, couldn't be, he's at Microsoft, he's top, one of the top guys there, he couldn't be any more inside than that.
Could not be.
And he just describes opening up the magazine and thinking, wait a second, I've missed the boat. Something's going on here,
right.
And I don't know what it is. And I think that story testifies to what was going on there, which was really a theatrical effect. And Lewis, and another name that has to be mentioned here is John Plunkett, who was the great graphic designer and creative director, actually with his wife, Barbara Kerr, of the magazine.
Who also brought that kind of 60s visual sensibility, that day-glow sensibility that Wired was famous for.
They created a theater of shock in that magazine and of intimidation, really. They were trying to make people feel that there was something happening that they didn't understand. And they understood their audience very well, because for a lot of people, certainly it's a turnoff. You open it up, you don't get it. You say, blech, what is this? You know, I'm not interested. But if you're aiming at technologists, a lot of whom are autodidacts, they're self-taught, they're used to looking at problems, they're excited by trying to figure something out, and you make a theater of the unknown, but the decipherable. You don't understand it right away, but you can get it if you pay some attention, and you've created something that they can't resist. And
come
I think
on
that was really the
you,
secret of that design.
Right, and you too will get it. That's great phrase of the 90s. John Plunkett in your book describes himself at one point rather bitterly as Louis Rossetto's slave.
Yes.
because Rossetto just had, as you say, this kind of force field. There was one astonishing passage where you describe him talking with some, I don't know, staff at Wired, trying to keep them on board, keep them with the program. And now he describes history, I mean, the depth of this man's belief. He described history as an inflection point where their actions today could affect human destiny far, far into the future. And that it was impossible to overestimate. He talks about Haymarket Square there. Do you remember that passage and the gist of it?
You know, of course, I don't have it memorized, but, you know, I think that is a very telling moment, because he was so, Louis Rossetto was very well informed, and he was very soft-spoken, surprisingly. He didn't raise his voice, but he had extraordinary self-confidence. And that combination of self-confidence and vast stores of information made him very devastating in a conversation. And he could go back in history and find an analog, a historical parallel, and make you feel that if you left this company, you might be responsible for a new age of Nazi repression that could occur.
Exactly. He tells this pair, Will and Kristen, he says, look, back in 1886, the Haymarket riots in Chicago, a bomb went off. No one knows who put it off. As a result, the eight-hour day never came to be. Anarchists were hung. And from this, we get communism and the rise of Nazism. I mean, he's talking about working at Wired, and he's talking about global inflection. And yet, it's believers like that who drive an awful lot of what really goes on in this world. Let's take another call. Sorry, Gary.
No, go ahead. Take the call. I'm interested.
Okay. Carlotta's calling from Carlotta from Salem, Massachusetts. Hi, Carlotta.
Yes, hello. I was in the that 60s transition from the mainframe where we were in Cambridge. And I wanted to say was I wanted to widen the lens. We were in the capacitor to resistor part where we were making a desktop computer simulator. Mm-hmm. And what I wanted to widen was that the lens really, when you're talking force field reveals an implicate order. It would be important to look here that this is part of a larger planetary transformational change. And what Rosetto was talking about is to be found in chaos theory or systems theory. David Bohm mm-hmm. was writing about it. Meg Wheatley
yes.
is writing about it. And so it's not just political, and it's really capitalism is not a sure thing in this. As far as how will the chaos, how will the change, the transformation come about? There are no guarantees
right.
in this. And he was tuned into this.
Very tuned in.
Gary
Wolf describes him as being, again, kind of in love with those border zones that were half catastrophe and half paradise.
Yes.
ideal for chaos.
Yes. And the model is in nature, which, it goes for self-organizing systems when left on its own.
So here's a voice from computers in the 60s still saying, don't give it up. Carlotta, we've got it. And forgive me, my time's running down. And I want to get Gary, thanks for your call. But Gary, where do you finally come out on Louis Rosetto on Wired? You know that he took a lot of flack later on, Wired did, as being an uncritical tout of the boom that
yes.
went bust. But yet I feel an affection in the way that you approach him and the whole subject here. Did the vision come to pass in some dimension? Are we living in it now? Is it still in the future? Was it just Lewis's dream?
Well, I think that if the main thing you feel out of that decade is that your wallet is lighter, nothing that I can say about Lewis or about Wired is going to take away that sting. Mm-hmm. And, I happen to be lucky enough in that that wasn't my main focus. And I think there are a lot of other people for whom the rise and fall of the stock market doesn't tell the whole story.
Not the defining frame for you.
Exactly. And I think there's some ironies in the book which really do express how I feel about Lewis, in the sense that here was a guy who believed that the market was always right. The market is right by definition.
Mm-hmm.
And then the market seems to back up his philosophy by making him a huge success. So, how hard is that to resist?
You went away with $30 million when it was all
yes, exactly.
Huge.
But I think at the point where he gets involved with some financiers and they break up his magazine and mm-hmm. sell it and get rid of it, he ends up with a bunch of money, but he also ends up very angry. And I think he ends up feeling that the effect of the influence upon him of some of his commitments, which are not purely commitments to market success. And I think that in a way that the story is about that. It's about somebody who has a lot to say that I really value. It gets entangled with a market phenomenon, or it's by essence entangled with the market phenomenon, and that simplifies the message and ultimately, in a way, subverts the message.
Well, it's an incredible story, and we thank you for sharing it. It sort of puts that whole decade into a perspective that's awfully valuable. You quote him, Louis Rosetto, in an email saying, "Is it hubris to have dreams, to try to make them real?" Well, that was one grand try, I have to
yes.
say. Gary Wolf, thank you so much for being with
thank
us tonight.
You.
It's a terrific book, Wired, A Romance. Can't recommend it enough. What are you up to these days, Gary? What's next?
I'm finishing a novel.
Oh, we'll look forward
yes.
to that. Thanks for joining us tonight. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Just click on forums. In a moment, a mother waits for her son to return home from Iraq. This is On Point. An American soldier and his Iraqi interpreter were killed this morning when their vehicle came under fire in Baghdad. The incident followed the deaths of two more soldiers when their convoy was ambushed west of Mosul yesterday. 38 American troops have been killed in Iraq since President Bush declared an end to major combat on May 1st. But the fighting seems far from over. For more than 11 weeks now, families of U.S. soldiers in Iraq have been watching the body count rise, and they are waiting and wondering when they will be able to welcome their loved ones home. Susan Hackley's 22-year-old son, Zach, has been in the region since January. In this radio diary, she describes the long wait for her son to come home.
My son, Zach, took a year off after high school to hike the 2,000-mile-long Appalachian Trail. I'd plot his progress on a map tacked up on a wall in the kitchen. and I relished his phone calls home when he'd recount his adventures and tell me about the amazing people he'd met. I worried plenty. He was 18 years old, alone at night, camping on the trail. And I looked forward to his finishing and heading off to college. But a few months before he was due to start, he told me he wouldn't be going. He was joining the Marine Corps. I was stunned. My college boyfriend had died in Vietnam. I had been a Vietnam War protester. I am a liberal Democrat. I work in the field of conflict resolution. But what about college, I asked. You're an honor student. If you want to be a Marine, why don't you join after college so you could be an officer? He explained, I want to be in the infantry, a grunt, one of the guys sent in to get the job done. I didn't get it. Zach was a sensitive, funny, laid-back kid in baggy pants who loved the freedom of hiking and marching to his own drum. Why the Marine Corps? Why not the Peace Corps, I suggested. But Zach made it clear. He was going to do what he wanted to do, not what I thought he ought to do. Zach had plans for when he finished his 4-year tour of duty. He'd hike the Appalachian Trail again, this time with some Marine Corps buddies, and after that he'd be ready for college. But then came September 11th and the war on terrorism. Zach and his unit were sent by ship west across the Pacific. Once again, I tracked his progress on a map in the kitchen. Singapore, Thailand, Kenya, Oman, and into the Persian Gulf. It was frightening, but he came home safely, and I breathed a sigh of relief. Then in January of this year, he headed back to the Gulf to join the military buildup around Iraq. As final diplomatic efforts failed, we knew war was imminent. Our troops headed into Iraq, and there was no more contact with Zach. Every morning, I'd come downstairs to read in the newspaper about ambushes, prisoners of war, suicide bombers, and house-to-house fighting. I watched CNN about 6 hours a day, desperate for news about his unit, Alpha Company, 1st Battalion, 4th Marines. Zach was in combat in Nasiriyah, the city in southeast Iraq, where some of the bloodiest battles were being fought. Waiting, wondering what Zach was going through, was pure anguish. I'd hear of casualties and hold my breath. Each day I'd drive home from work and pray there wouldn't be people in uniform standing at my front door. Finally, in mid-April, days before his 22nd birthday, we heard from Zach. He was standing guard at a United Nations facility in Baghdad, where he was able to use a telephone. He sounded weary and said he'd seen a lot of tough things. He'd been shot at and felt lucky that the Iraqi soldiers seemed to have lousy aim. We came into Baghdad, he said, and half the city was on fire. Yet people were glad to see us. They shook our hands, invited us to their homes, and asked for autographs. The war was over, and we all thought my son was going to be home soon. Now it's mid-July, and Zach and his unit are still in Iraq. They are the soldiers patrolling the streets and raiding the hideouts of armed Iraqi insurgents. They try to gauge who's friendly and who's not. Once an angry mob of several thousand Iraqis pushed up against 100 or so of the Marines, clamoring for more pay. Every day brings more attacks against our troops, and I hesitate every time I hear the doorbell ring. Zach tells me the time passes slowly in Iraq. It moves slowly for me, too. 2.5 months after the war, I'm still waiting for my son to come home.
Susan Hackley lives in Boston, Massachusetts. Her son, Zach, is a member of Alpha Company, 1st Battalion, 4th Marines, in Iraq. Listeners, we'd like to hear from you. How are events around the world or here at home affecting you, your family, friends, your thoughts? Send us your experience, your ideas at onpoint@wbur.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for this program comes